From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, former State Senate leader Dean Skelos and his son Adam's federal corruption convictions are overturned. Our political observer Alan Shartok will share his thoughts on the second conviction overturned under the term of federal prosecutor Preet Bharara, and drones are being sent across the state to help with the environment, conservation, and emergency response efforts. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Former State Senate leader Dean Skelos and his son Adam saw their federal corruption convictions overturned by a federal appeals court panel this week. Skelos is the second former legislative leader to win his case on appeal in the past 2 months after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling revised the laws under which they were convicted. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The Skeloses were convicted in December of 2015 of extortion and bribery in an alleged scheme by the elder Skelos to use his political influence to steer work and to award a no-show job to his son. Prosecutors say they will retry them. Acting U.S. Attorney for the Southern District, June Kim, said in a statement that while he is disappointed in the decision, there was overwhelming evidence that was more than sufficient to convict Dean and Adam Skelos. Kim replaced U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who oversaw the Skelos' cases after Bharara was fired by President Trump. Kim says the only issue in the appeals panel decision is that the jury instructions were incorrect because of a recent Supreme Court decision. Susan Lerner, with the government reform group Common Cause, says that's a key point.
We think that it's extremely likely that another 12 New Yorkers will look at this conduct, apply their common sense under the corrected legal standard, and they'll find that this is objectionable conduct yet again.
It is the second time in recent months that the conviction of a former legislative leader has been overturned on appeal. Former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver in July also saw his 2015 conviction on bribery and kickback charges rescinded. He's also facing retrial. Both former legislative leaders are benefiting from a 2016 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that occurred after their trials. It reversed corruption charges against former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife. The court ruled that federal attorneys had interpreted the law too broadly and that the jury was not properly instructed on the meaning of an official act within the federal bribery statutes. Dean and Adam Skelos were sentenced to prison terms of 5 and 6.5 years, but they've remained free on bail as they awaited the appeal result. Lerner, with Common Cause, says New York State should enact reforms and make changes to its laws so that the actions by the former legislative leaders are clearly prohibited.
There really should never be a question of whether an individual elected official uses taxpayer-funded resources to get advantages or jobs or favors for his or her family, that's illegal, period. This shouldn't be a question.
State lawmakers have so far not approved a range of reform proposals, including banning outside income for legislators. They have agreed to a proposal to let a judge decide whether to rescind the pensions of politicians who are convicted of felonies. That measure goes before voters in November. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, our political observer, Alan Shartok. Alan, this week, as we just heard from our Karen DeWitt,
former Senate leader Dean Skelos and his son's convictions overturned, and it's on the heels of the overturning of the Sheldon Silver, former speaker's conviction case, and also a look toward Preet Bharara.
Well, look, this is the fruit of the Supreme Court saying you really have to have a quid pro quo that is very, very exact. Now, what's interesting in all of these cases is that no judge has said they're not guilty. They're saying the instructions to the jury were deficient. But there has been assertions that there's a lot of meat to these charges. These men are being retried as a result of this. Barrera, I think we'll never know, because the President of the United States kicked him out, and we don't know what he would have done to argue differently or to present his case differently now. Barrera is out, and one really can't say that this is his fault. He's gone. He was fired.
The Trump administration, of course, yesterday unveiled the most sweeping changes to the federal tax code in decades, outlining a framework that would cut individual and corporate taxes, eliminate widely used exemptions and deductions, and tilt the U.S. closer to the type of tax system embraced by other industrialized nations. Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo in New York calls it a death blow for the state.
It would be a death blow because right now we are allowed to deduct state and local taxes. Now, when that happens, the blue states like New York make out better than the people who don't have major state taxes. I live in Massachusetts, sometimes called Taxachusetts. I work in New York State, where I'm also taxed. And those taxes, by being able to deduct them, you basically defray much of the onus that you have on you. So he's right. It would be a terrible blow to the blue states. And of course, Trump is no dope. He knows it. This is, I'll get even with you if you're going to vote the wrong way against me, blue states. And he's doing that. The two remaining deductions, of course, there would be real tax revolution if he didn't allow them to go through, are gifts to not-for-profits, charitable giving, and your ability to deduct taxes for your mortgage on your home. So those are two that'll stay. Everything else goes. There's a shell game going on as to whether or not the people at the top would get a tax deduction. I'm going to make a prediction. Ready? They will. If they weren't going to lower taxes on the very rich, we'd hear about that. But no such thing is happening. And then there's always the question, David, about how we're going to pay for this. And now they're resorting to the same old, that the way we're going to pay for this is we're going to increase the way in which people spend, and that will pay for it. Nonsense.
Alan, well, of course, Governor Cuomo, as we spoke, not happy with the tax cut proposal by the Trump administration, but it marks a series of efforts by the governor, which seem to, cynically or not, point to his rumored run for president in 2020. I'm also talking about things like Puerto Rico.
He is running for president. Of course he's running for president. And if you don't believe that, take another walk in the woods with a bear. I'm telling you now, the guy's running for president, and he is doing what he needs to do. And frankly, I think it's helping him, because he's got a worthy opponent in Donald Trump who is really trying to put it to the blue states. And let there be no mistake about it, when you say you are not going to be allowed to deduct your state and state funds and your state taxes from your income tax, that is a serious body blow for the states who tax the most. I'm sure the president knows it, and I'm sure that the governor knows it. This is going to be having to be duked out in the United States Congress, where a lot of people live. They live there by virtue of their representatives, and so we'll just see whether that deduction goes forward. We'll also see whether his pledge, the president's pledge, that this is going to be a middle-class tax cut, turns out to be right, or whether it's just a wolf in sheep's clothing that is just one more way in which the rich can profit in this country.
Now let's talk 2018 and Governor Cuomo's reelection. We know that Ed Cox, the head of the Republican Party in the state, thinks that the Republicans have a great chance this time around. Probably no surprise. And Harry Wilson seems to be the one that has moved up to the top of the list. However, you just mentioned Trump is very unpopular in New York.
Well, yes, I think that the curse of Trump on any Republican in a state which really abhors him, voters are going to come out and they're going to say no, especially if the gubernatorial candidate isn't smart enough to put some real substantial difference between themselves and the president. Look, in Massachusetts next door, where I live, a Republican governor, Baker, has made it very clear that he wants nothing to do with this president on things like health care and other things. So I suspect if Mr. Wilson, who is a numbers guy and kind of obscure, is not to be a who-he, WHO-HE question mark, if he's not to be a who-he, he'll have to come out and he'll have to really let Trump know that he has no friend in him. I doubt that that is going to happen. And I also think, by the way, that the Republicans blew it. They had an ideal candidate who really did make the rounds, wanted to run for president in Chris Gibson. He was congressman in the district that is now represented by John Faso. Immensely popular, a sort of progressive Republican. If they had really been serious about wanting to win this election, he would have been an ideal candidate. Now, not a lot of people knew him. But, you know, nobody knew who George Pataki was either. They had an unpopular incumbent in Andrew Cuomo's father. That meant something. I think that the Republicans don't have anybody substantial to run against Andrew Cuomo.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation announced this week that it's sending 22 drones across the state to, quote, enhance environmental management, conservation, and emergency response efforts. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains the unmanned aerial vehicles have already proven their worth in hurricane-ravaged Texas.
At the rollout, DEC officials said they anticipated using drones for natural disaster relief and recovery, along with search and rescue missions, forest fire suppression, wildlife management, invasive species detection, and forest health evaluations. According to a press release, 14 DEC pilots trained for several months under the guidance of the Northeast UAS Airspace Integration Research Team at the FAA's UAS test site at Griffiths International Airport in Rome, one of only six such sites in the nation. Bruce Lomnitzer is a forest ranger for Region 5 out of Indian Lake. He's also a drone pilot for the DEC, just back from search and rescue in Houston.
Some of the things I was flying, some of the staging areas, just so our management team could actually figure out what was out there. The other thing I did was fly some of the damaged areas, flooded, and also some of the gutting houses, checked all that stuff out. The biggest thing I would say that I brought to it was just a little bit better situational awareness of what exactly the devastation was and what's going on from an aerial view.
DEC deployed two drones to Texas to help aid in Hurricane Harvey disaster response.
One of the biggest things with the drone is it just gives you that aerial perspective. Instead of looking through binoculars, now I can take the drone and get it up in the air and get it closer to objects or subject, depending on what you need to be.
The drones significantly reduce the hazard for responders and improve response time, according to the DEC.
GPS was terrible because it didn't have a clue of what roads were closed. When we were in West Houston, it was taking a long time to get anywhere because of so many different roads being flooded out and closed, and not all the side roads were on the iDrive Texas website. So what I was able to do was put the drone up in the air, see which roads were open, see if they were going to get us to where we wanted to go, and shorten some of our trips. Like before I started using the drone, it would take us like an hour and a half to do like a 7-minute drive.
Forest Ranger Captain Adam Pickett is section chief at Albany's division office. He says drones provide enhanced levels of intelligence, far superior to now old-fashioned ground troops and helicopters.
They'd be trying to call back on the radio and describe what they're seeing, you know, through words. And as we all know, pictures are worth a thousand of those. So using the drone platform to give us those images so that we can analyze them, multiple people can analyze the same information at once, it really helps speed up the response time.
Governor Andrew Cuomo sent three drones and two DEC operators to Puerto Rico to assist the New York Power Authority in restoring the island's grid and carrying out other emergency response missions. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A utility company in the Hudson Valley has agreed to implement customer service improvements following a New York State Public Service Commission investigation. The investigation began after a low-income advocacy group alleged the company was using unfair collection practices. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
The Public Service Commission initiated its investigation into Central Hudson Gas and Electric after complaints from low-income advocacy group Nobody Leaves Mid-Hudson. Nobody Leaves Mid-Hudson Executive Director Jonathan Bix says his grassroots group, along with the Public Utility Law Project of New York, brought the complaints after the following.
We talked to thousands of people in Central Hudson service territory, and we're consistently seeing shutoffs despite cold temperatures, despite households that had serious medical issues. And so as we talked to more and more people, it just became clear that it was a systematic problem. And so we collected testimonies and stories from people and then submitted a request for the investigation.
John Masurgin is spokesman for Poughkeepsie-based Central Hudson.
Well, we thought those allegations were grossly unfair and completely misrepresented our practices. We work with our vulnerable customers one-on-one. We take great care and pride in our ability to help customers through financial difficulties.
The PSC investigation found that Central Hudson is in compliance with the Home Energy Fair Practices Act, but that there are opportunities to further improve termination processes and procedures. The PSC investigation also found no evidence of trends suggesting systemic improper practices or procedures. In many instances, according to the PSC, disputes between customers and Central Hudson arose or were prolonged because of customer failures or delays in providing appropriate documentation. Again, Ms. Surgeon.
So we really feel vindicated that there were no instances of violations of not following the Home Energy Fair Practices Act rules and regulations, that there were no instances of discrimination. And that's what we had said all along, and we really feel that the Public Service Commission did their due diligence and found that we were in compliance with all the rules and regulations and that we do treat our customers fairly.
Bix responds to the outcome of the PSC investigation.
And so we're pleased that as a result of these findings, Central Hudson's going to raise the debt threshold they use to determine shutoffs, raise the debt threshold during the winter, especially compared to other times of year, and prioritizing shutoffs and accounts with the oldest and greatest arrears, and not focusing also on how they can the most efficiently shut off the most people. And we're glad they're instituting a number of other measures as well to try to reduce shutoffs.
The commission also said the utility has agreed to revise training materials for customer service representatives to ensure they provide appropriate guidance for transferring debts where the customer claims identity theft. And the company will provide additional training to ensure employees handle complaints in a manner consistent with the state's utility consumer protection rules and the company's training and reference materials. Ms. Surgeon says Central Hudson will be working with the PSC in clarifying the recommendations and making any necessary adjustments.
And in fact, the PSC did say that they'll be working with us as we make these adjustments, and we'll be meeting in the spring to review how these adjustments have been going.
The PSC found Central Hudson performed 11,304 residential terminations in 2016, about 4.3% of its total residential customers. That's higher than the average rate of all New York State utilities, which was 3.1%. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Republican Policy Committee is an advisory group to two GOP members in the U.S. House. Its two task forces, law enforcement and millennials, assess policy issues that could lead to legislation. For the past couple of years, the Millennial Task Force has been looking at young people in the workplace and how they are affecting the economy. Chaired by Northern New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of the 21st District, the panel held a hearing on the challenges and opportunities for millennials in the hydropower industry. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
The goal of the task force hearing was to assess the opportunities and challenges the hydropower industry has in recruiting millennial workers. Representative Elise Stefanik said they have learned in previous meetings that workplaces are becoming more dynamic as millennials change how they consume products, including energy. She said that is leading to more demand for renewables, resulting in more job opportunities in that sector.
Just last year, renewable energy reached its highest ever production levels, with hydropower accounting for 25% more than solar and wind combined. What makes these totals even more promising is the potential for massive growth within the hydropower sector. To make this expansion a reality, the hydropower industry needs a robust workforce. In fact, some reports indicate there could be over 1 million jobs in the hydropower sector if the industry meets its domestic potential. Unfortunately, the hydropower industry is facing an aging workforce and has not been able to attract as many millennials as solar and wind sectors have.
Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions Director of Policy Charles Hernick says hydropower offers a number of emerging technologies that meet the eco concerns of millennials.
We're very familiar with the iconic conventional hydropower technologies, dams. This type of conventional hydropower project represents the clear majority of U.S. hydropower generation. But the frontier of hydropower looks quite different and leaves behind many of the environmental and social challenges that building dams creates. The future of hydropower includes ocean wave, tidal, and hydrokinetic power. It also includes run-of-the-river approaches that maximize power generation and minimize disruptions to the river that affect local economies and often affect fishery-dependent economies miles away.
Brookfield Renewable Director of Northeast Operations Justin Trudell reinforced that hydro has been stereotyped as old-fashioned and therefore does not get its fair share of the clean power spotlight nor interest as a job opportunity.
Across the U.S., hydro has been part of the energy mix of most states for many decades. Interestingly, however, hydropower's importance to the electric grid is increasing as it rapidly evolves and decarbonizes. Many millennials may not recognize the importance of hydropower as a baseload, flexible, and non-emitting resource that is actively enabling the grid of the future.
Stefanik said the hearing highlights numerous opportunities for young people.
Part of the challenges hydro faces is an awareness challenge. Hopefully this is one small step in coming up with policy solutions to help bridge that gap. I think the themes that we touched on in terms of workforce development, how you develop that pipeline at each step, whether it's graduating from high school, graduating with in vocational or technical program, graduating as an undergrad or in graduate school, that there are opportunities out there in hydro, and those opportunities are only going to grow.
According to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers National Inventory of Dams, there are over 80,000 dams 3 feet or higher in the country. About 2,500 produce hydropower.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1738, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.